Part 2. Capturing the Counterculture. By Josh Stileman at brownstone.org. In Part 1, we traced the development of structures of oversight from Edison's physical monopolies through Tavistock's psychological operations, witnessing how corporate and banking interests and intelligence agencies converged to shape public consciousness. Now we'll see how these methods reached new sophistication through popular culture, beginning with the British invasion of the 1960s, which demonstrated how thoroughly orchestrated music movements could reshape society. The Beatles and Rolling Stones weren't just bands, as researcher Mike Williams has extensively documented in his analysis of the British invasion. Their emergence marked the beginning of a systematic and profound cultural transformation. Williams notes that even the term British invasion itself was telling, a military metaphor for what was ostensibly a cultural phenomenon, perhaps Tavistock telegraphing its operation in plain sight. What seemed like playful marketing language actually described a carefully orchestrated infiltration of American youth culture. Through hundreds of hours of meticulously documented research, Williams builds an overwhelming case that the Beatles served as the spearhead of a broader agenda that used albums like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and the Rolling Stones' Their Satanic Majesty's Request to deliberately steer youth culture away from traditional values and family structures. What seems tame by today's standards represented a calculated assault on social norms, initiating a cultural transformation that would accelerate over the following decades. Williams's research goes further, presenting compelling evidence that the Beatles were essentially the first modern boy band, their image carefully crafted, their music largely written and performed by others. This revelation transforms our understanding of the British invasion. What appeared to be an organic cultural phenomenon was in fact a meticulously orchestrated operation, with professional musicians and songwriters behind the scenes while the Beatles served as appealing frontmen for the massive social engineering project. As a lifelong music fan and Beatles devotee, confronting this evidence initially felt like sacrilege. Yet the pattern becomes undeniable once you allow yourself to see it. While debate continues over specific details like the Frankfurt School's Theodor Adorno's alleged involvement in crafting Beatles songs, a claim that has both passionate proponents and critics, what's clear is that the operation bore all the hallmarks of Tavistock's social engineering methodology. The deliberate crafting of a good boys, bad boys, Beatles, Rolling Stones dialectic offered controlled choices and allowed both sides to advance the exact same desired cultural shifts. Andrew Loog Oldham masterfully crafted the Stones' bad boy image using public relations techniques reminiscent of Edward Bernays' methods, the father of public relations who pioneered mass psychological manipulation, creating desire through psychological insight and manufacturing cultural rebellion as a marketable commodity. As Oldham himself acknowledged in his autobiography, he wasn't just selling music but rather rebellion, anarchy, and sex appeal wrapped up in a neat package, deliberately creating a myth for people to buy into. His sophisticated understanding of cultural branding and mass psychology reflected the broader methods of influence that were reshaping media and public opinion during the era. Behind Mick Jagger's rebellious persona lay an education at the London School of Economics, suggesting an insider with a deeper understanding of power systems at play. This assiduous development of image extended to the performer's inner circle, notably Jagger's girlfriend Marianne Faithfull, herself a successful singer and socialite, whose father was an MI6 officer who interrogated Heinrich Himmler and whose maternal grandfather had Habsburg dynasty roots. The Stones' finances were managed by Prince Rupert Lauenstein, a Bavarian aristocrat and private banker whose noble lineage and financial circles intersected with the Rothschild dynasty. Another example of establishment figures behind seemingly anti-establishment movements. Even the record label itself fit the pattern. EMI, Electric and Musical Industries, which signed both the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, began as a military electronics company. During World War II, EMI's research and development contributed significantly to Britain's radar program and other military technologies. This fusion of military industrial interests with cultural production was no coincidence. EMI's technical expertise in electronics and communications would prove valuable in both warfare and the mass distribution of cultural content. These carefully managed British experiments in cultural control would soon find their perfect laboratory in America, where an unlikely convergence would reshape youth culture and the family unit forever. Britain had pioneered these methods of cultural orchestration through music, embedding intelligence ties into the British invasion, but America would refine and scale these techniques to unprecedented levels. The Laurel Canyon Laboratory. In the hills above Hollywood between 1965 to 1975, as journalist Dave McGowan first documented, an extraordinary phenomenon. The emergence of a new music scene centered in Laurel Canyon, where an improbable concentration of military and intelligence family connections converged to reshape American youth culture. This convergence was no accident. As anti-war sentiment grew strongest in academic circles, this military-intelligence nexus helped redirect potential resistance into a drug-saturated counterculture focused on dropping out rather than organized opposition to the war. The military-intelligence connections within Laurel Canyon were striking. Jim Morrison's father commanded the fleet during the Gulf of Tonkin incident that launched the Vietnam War. Frank Zappa's father was a chemical warfare specialist at Edgewood Arsenal, a key human experimentation research site. David Crosby, scion of the Van Cortlandts and Van Rensselaers, American royalty, descended from a lineage of political power that included senators, Supreme Court justices, and revolutionary generals. James Taylor, a descendant of Massachusetts Bay Colony settlers, grew up in a family shaped by academia and military service, including his father's role in Operation Deep Freeze in Antarctica. Sharon Tate, daughter of Army Intelligence Officer Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tate, moved through these circles before her death. Dennis Hopper, whose father was Oz, directed Easy Rider and starred in it with Peter Fonda, packaging counterculture rebellion for mainstream consumption. The transformation was systematic. From the post-war optimism and unity embodied by JFK's New Frontier to the calculated fragmentation that followed his assassination. This mass shared public trauma, perfectly suited to Tavistock's methods of social engineering through psychological shock, marked the end of genuine optimism. The boomers, raised with unprecedented prosperity and inspired by Kennedy's vision of a new frontier, saw their potential for authentic social and political transformation redirected into carefully crafted cultural movements that would shape subsequent generations. These pervasive connections between military intelligence figures and countercultural leaders, from Morrison's admiral father to Zappa's chemical warfare specialist parent to Crosby's political dynasty, reveal a clear pattern: the systematic co-opting of youth culture by establishment powers. The timing of Laurel Canyon's emergence as a counterculture hub coincided with the CIA's MK-Ultra's mind control program's peak years of operation. This was no coincidence. The same organizations experimenting with consciousness control through chemical methods, such as LSD, were simultaneously embedding themselves in cultural programming efforts. The convergence of these strategies in Laurel Canyon laid the groundwork for what would soon become the full-scale fusion of music and psychedelics. A calculated effort to thwart organically arising political resistance by channeling it into a movement centered on personal transcendence rather than effective collective action. Programming the revolution. Building on the psychological and cultural groundwork established in Laurel Canyon, the fusion of music and psychedelics marked the apex of consciousness manipulation. This phase of mass cultural programming strategically redirected genuine political resistance into artificially managed cultural channels, steering dissent away from organized movements and into fragmented, drug-fueled withdrawal. Even the Grateful Dead, the quintessential embodiment of California counterculture, which cultivated a devoted following that defined a generation's search for community and meaning, were intricately tied to mechanisms of societal control. Their manager, Alan Trist, was not only the son of Tavistock founder Eric Trist but was also present at the pivotal car accident that killed Jerry Garcia's childhood friend, Paul Spiegel, a tragedy that set Garcia on the path to forming the band. Garcia's military connection adds another layer of intrigue. After stealing his mother's car in 1960, he was offered the choice between prison or military service. Despite repeatedly going AWOL from Fort Ord and the Presidio of San Francisco, Garcia received only a general discharge, an unusually lenient outcome that raises questions about potential official connections. Meanwhile, the band's lyricist, Robert Hunter, participated in government-funded LSD experiments tied to the broader psychedelic research of the era. Serving as the house band for the CIA-connected Merry Pranksters, the Grateful Dead played a key role in steering anti-war sentiment toward psychedelic retreat, aligning the counterculture with state-sponsored agendas in ways that warrant deeper scrutiny. This alignment of counterculture and establishment interests proved wildly effective. As anti-war sentiment grew strongest in academic circles, where genuine resistance could threaten structural power, the emergence of the hippie movement effectively redirected opposition into a youth counterculture saturated with drugs and focused on escapism rather than organized resistance. As the war machine escalated operations in Vietnam, young Americans were guided toward cultural dissolution, a perfect formula for neutralizing meaningful peace movements. The same military intelligence complex that drove the war was simultaneously molding the culture that would prevent effective resistance to it. Timothy Leary's role in this transformation was crucial. Before becoming the psychedelic movement's most influential voice, he had been a West Point cadet and would later serve as an FBI informant. His advocacy for psychedelics emerged alongside the CIA's own exploration of substances like LSD during the MKUltra era. John Lennon later reflected on this confluence with biting irony. "We must always remember to thank the CIA and the Army for LSD. That's what people forget. They invented LSD to control people, and what they did was give us freedom." This seeming backfire of the program masked a deeper success, dismantling potential resistance through the promotion of chemical disengagement. By popularizing the mantra, "Turn on, tune in, drop out," Leary advanced this agenda. This redirection not only fragmented youth opposition, but weakened their ties to traditional support systems such as families and communities, exactly the kind of social atomization that would make future control easier. The overlap between government-funded LSD research and the emerging music scene was far from coincidental. While MKUltra explored chemical means of consciousness control, the music industry was simultaneously perfecting cultural methods, with bands like the Grateful Dead bridging both worlds through their ties to government-backed LSD experiments and the rapidly growing counterculture. Redirecting resistance. Patterns of government leadership connections to musical movements weren't limited to the psychedelic era. As popular music evolves through new genres and decades, the same underlying relationships continue between establishment power and cultural influence. In the hardcore punk scene, figures like Ian McKay, Minor Threat, Fugazi, whose father was in the White House press corps and present at JFK's assassination, would ironically become one of the most fiercely independent figures in music, pioneering the DIY ethic through his label Discod Records. His autonomous approach seemed to resist the system, yet his establishment connections highlight a broader pattern. Even in alternative rock, Dave Grohl's father served as special assistant to Senator Robert Taft Jr. during the Reagan administration. Madonna, who became the defining pop star of the 1980s, was the daughter of Tony Ciccone, an engineer who worked on military projects for Chrysler Defense and General Dynamics Land Systems. Having parents involved in government, defense, or intelligence work doesn't imply wrongdoing by these artists. However, these examples represent just a fraction of the documented connections between counterculture figures and power structures. The pattern extends across decades and genres, with hundreds of similar cases suggesting not coincidence but systematic design, from jazz musicians backed by banking families to punk rockers with government connections to mainstream pop stars from defense industry families. These pervasive ties raise fundamental questions about the relationship between ruling class power and cultural influence. Perhaps no single family better exemplifies the deliberate fusion of intelligence operations and cultural production than the Copelands. Miles Copeland Jr., who helped found the CIA and orchestrated coups across the Middle East, detailed the psychological strategies behind this integration in his book The Game of Nations. In that revealing text, Copeland explicitly outlined the manipulation methodology that would shape both intelligence operations and popular culture. In the world of covert operations, nothing is what it appears to be. The key is not just controlling actions, but controlling the perception of actions. His son Miles Copeland III became a key figure in the music industry, managing influential acts like The Police, with brother Stewart as drummer, and founding IRS Records. Through IRS, Copeland would shape alternative music's mainstream emergence, managing acts like REM fronted by Michael Stipe, another military child. The Copelands represent a crucial bridge between covert operations and cultural production, demonstrating how intelligence methodologies evolved from direct intervention to subtle influence through entertainment. Their success in blending counterculture appeal with commercial viability became a template for future narrative sculpting. This pattern of cultural engineering follows historically consistent principles. Artists and movements aligning with intelligence objectives receive overwhelming promotion, while genuine resistance faces suppression or elimination. The tragic ends of figures like Phil Ochs and John Lennon, both under documented FBI surveillance for their direct challenges to state power, contrast notably with the career trajectories of those who presented rebellion within more conventional bounds. Manufacturing gender. While music proved to be the perfect laboratory for testing mass consciousness control, These methods would soon extend far beyond entertainment. Nowhere was this more evident than in the deliberate reshaping of gender roles and family structures, with the goal of transforming intimate aspects of human identity and relationships. The strategic calibration of feminist narratives emerged as a particularly powerful example, with intelligence agencies actively shaping gender politics through media and organized activism. Gloria Steinem, who acknowledged working with CIA-funded organizations like the Independent Research Service during the 1950s and 1960s, exemplifies this intersection. Her Ms. magazine, launched in 1972, merged feminist ideals with carefully curated messaging, while Steinem later admitted to participating in CIA-funded events aimed at influencing feminist movements during the Cold War. Nicholas Rockefeller's candid admission to his friend Aaron Russo underscored how women's liberation was strategically funded to expand state and corporate control, doubling the tax base through workforce participation, weakening family bonds through increased divorce rates, and increasing state influence over children via state-run childcare. During this same period, influential shows like That Girl and the Mary Tyler Moore Show helped normalize these very changes, popularizing the archetype of the independent, career-focused woman in ways that notably aligned with systemic objectives. This transformation was systematic. Women's magazines shifted from primarily domestic content to increasingly career-focused messaging. Cosmopolitan's dramatic evolution under Helen Gurley Brown's editorship in the 1960s exemplified this transformation, normalizing not just women's workforce participation but also promoting sexual liberation outside traditional marriage, a dual agenda that aligned perfectly with corporate interests in expanding both the labor pool and consumer base. This deliberate shaping of gender movements extends to the present, with Tavistock Institute continuing to form modern narratives. From shifting women's magazines toward career messaging in the 1960s to today's relentless promotion of evolving gender narratives, these movements consistently align with agenda-driven objectives. Commodifying resistance. The techniques perfected in Laurel Canyon for transforming genuine resistance into profitable cultural products would evolve into increasingly complex frameworks of control. From the Grateful Dead's pioneering of festival culture to modern corporate music festivals like Coachella, authentic counterculture spaces would be systematically converted into commercial enterprises. By the 1990s, these methods had evolved into systematic co-option of authentic resistance. While the boomers experienced the shift from optimism to disillusionment, Generation X faced a more highly refined mechanism that commodified alienation itself. Kurt Cobain's trajectory from authentic voice of generational discontent to MTV commodity demonstrated how the apparatus of influence had evolved, no longer just redirecting resistance but transforming it into profitable cultural products. This commodification extended beyond music. Brands like Nike transformed anti-establishment street culture into global marketing campaigns through figures like Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley. The era's alternative culture became so thoroughly commercialized that mall retailers like Hot Topic emerged to sell pre-packaged rebellion to suburban teens, turning countercultural symbols into standardized retail offerings. The comprehensive hijack of underground music scenes demonstrates how thoroughly the power structure perfected cultural manipulation. Just as intelligence agencies had redirected 60s counterculture, corporations developed advanced methods for capturing and commodifying organic dissidents. The Vans Warped Tour transformed punk rock, once a genuine expression of youth rebellion, into a traveling corporate marketing platform, complete with sponsored stages and branded merchandise. Red Bull's Music Academy program went further, creating what amounts to an early warning system for potentially disruptive cultural movements. By identifying emerging underground genres and artists early, they could redirect authentic cultural expression into commercial channels before it developed genuine revolutionary potential. Even the most fiercely independent scenes proved vulnerable to this system. Major labels created fake indie imprints to maintain underground credibility while controlling distribution. Tobacco companies specifically targeted underground clubs and raves, understanding that subcultural credibility could be converted into market share. The pattern established in Laurel Canyon, of transforming authentic resistance into profitable products, had evolved into a science of cultural capture. Just as the Grateful Dead's government connections helped establish templates for controlled cultural spaces, modern music festivals serve as data collection points and behavioral laboratories. The evolution from acid tests to algorithmically curated festival lineups demonstrates how thoroughly the framework of influence has digitized. The celebrity machine. The approach perfected through Gloria Steinem, channeling authentic social movements through carefully managed spokespersons, would evolve into today's meticulously crafted model of celebrity activism. This algorithmic management extends beyond content to talent itself, with platforms increasingly determining not just what succeeds but which voices rise to prominence. The strategic positioning of celebrity activists demonstrates how thoroughly institutional interests have penetrated entertainment. George Clooney's involvement with the Council on Foreign Relations, continuing a multi-generational family connection to power that began with his father Nick Clooney's Cold War-era journalism, exemplifies how these entertainment establishment ties often span generations. Angelina Jolie's evolution from Hollywood rebel to UNHCR special envoy exemplifies how countercultural appeal can be redirected toward state objectives. Similarly, Leonardo DiCaprio's environmental advocacy, promoted through WEF platforms while maintaining a private jet lifestyle, shows how even legitimate concerns are shaped to align with elite frameworks. Similarly, Sean Penn's pattern of high-profile crisis interventions, from Hurricane Katrina to Haiti, Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, and most recently Ukraine, raises questions about selective platform access. While establishment-aligned celebrities receive endless amplification, those questioning official narratives often find themselves swiftly marginalized or silenced. Like Steinem's CIA-backed feminist organizing, modern celebrity activism often aligns remarkably well with ruling class objectives. The path from counterculture figure to establishment voice has become a repeatable template. Marketing modern culture. Modern equivalents of countercultural programming demonstrate how these systems remain highly effective. From the entertainment industry to luxury fashion houses, today's cultural engineers craft narratives that align with elite interests under the guise of progress. This pattern of coordinated societal restructuring extends across multiple industries and platforms. The fashion industry's role became explicit through incidents like Balenciaga's controversial 2022 campaign featuring children with bondage imagery. While public outrage focused on the immediate controversy, the incident revealed how fashion houses increasingly push narratives about gender, sexuality, and social norms. Just as the Stones and Beatles channeled rebellion into acceptable forms, today's cultural architects craft carefully calibrated resistance. Billie Eilish's themes of alienation provide Gen Z with a commercially viable outlet for discontent, while Lizzo's challenge to conventional beauty standards align with corporate interests in promoting pharmaceuticals, wellness products, and consumer goods tailored to diverse audiences. Even the most commercially successful artists reflect these establishment connections. Taylor Swift's family ties to banking dynasties, including her grandfather's role in the Federal Reserve, demonstrate how thoroughly embedded these relationships remain. As researcher Mike Benz has documented, NATO's own training materials identify Swift as a key figure for message amplification, revealing how bureaucratic influence operates in the digital age. When health becomes ideology, the promotion of unhealthy lifestyles serves multiple systemic purposes. A population focused on body positivity, while struggling with obesity and chronic health conditions, becomes both more profitable for pharmaceutical companies and more dependent on institutional systems. This agenda manifests in how unhealthiness is celebrated as progressive and inclusive. Corporate campaigns and media portray obese body types and unhealthy lifestyles as empowering, normalizing behaviors that in most cases will lead to poor long-term health. For example, Cosmopolitan featured a February 2021 cover proclaiming, "This is healthy," alongside imagery of unconventional body types, while Nike introduced plus-size mannequins in their flagship stores, generating significant media buzz. These efforts were celebrated as milestones of inclusivity, solidifying the body positivity movement as a cultural touchstone. At the same time, fitness and working out are increasingly framed as symbols of extremism. Articles and think pieces link workout culture and physical health with dangerous ideologies, painting personal discipline as a marker of political radicalization. This patently absurd narrative subtly reframes exercise not as wellness and personal discipline, but as symbols of far-right extremism. This deliberate inversion mirrors Orwell's dystopia. Health becomes harmful, while unhealthiness becomes virtuous. By reframing physical well-being and self-improvement as forms of deviance, these narratives distort societal values, aligning them with complacency as a moral ideal. The seeds of this shift were planted during the COVID-19 pandemic, where public health policies largely ignored foundational wellness practices. Instead of promoting sunshine, exercise, proper nutrition, or weight loss. Despite obesity being the highest risk factor, official messaging emphasized isolation, masking, and compliance. In the post-pandemic era, these themes have evolved further, reframing personal health and discipline as not just unnecessary, but as politically dangerous. The treatment of health and fitness reveals a calculated agenda, promoting unhealthy lifestyles while demonizing physical discipline serves the same end, creating a more dependent and controllable population. This isn't contradiction but convergence. Both approaches push people away from self-reliance and toward institutional dependence. This isn't random contradiction but calculated deception. Just as Tavistock learned to use psychological vulnerability to reshape consciousness, modern organizations deploy health narratives to create new forms of social control. This systematic reshaping of health consciousness parallels an even broader transformation, the redefinition of citizenship and national identity itself. Just as physical fitness was reframed as extremism, traditional notions of patriotism and national pride would be carefully reconstructed to serve power structures. The entertainment industry, having perfected techniques for modifying health narratives, would deploy these same methods to reshape public understanding of loyalty and national purpose. Shaping patriotism. From the fitness industry to Hollywood, narratives are crafted to ensure compliance with systemic ideals, often echoing tactics first developed to reshape public sentiment during the isolationist era discussed earlier. Just as J.P. Morgan's acquisition of newspapers in 1917 helped frame America's reluctant entry into global conflicts as a moral imperative, television series, streaming shows, and films all shape public perceptions of military action by glamorizing its necessity and heroism. Modern blockbusters like Top Gun, Maverick demonstrate how studios must submit scripts to the Department of Defense for approval, with military-mandated changes required to access essential equipment and filming locations. The Pentagon's influence extends deep into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Captain Marvel required extensive script revisions to secure military support, transforming the protagonist from a civilian pilot into an Air Force officer. Similar military oversight shaped Iron Man, with the Pentagon demanding script approval in exchange for access to bases and equipment. These aren't just product placement deals, they represent systematic narrative control at the heart of modern entertainment. Other films, such as Zero Dark Thirty and Argo, have been produced in direct collaboration with the CIA, promoting narratives aligned with military interests. The NFL provides another striking example of how sports leagues function as extensions of the entertainment network, leveraging emotional narratives to shape public sentiment. Military flyovers, player tributes to soldiers, and Super Bowl advertisements are often presented as organic celebrations of national pride. However, these moments frequently stem from paid partnerships with the Department of Defense, blurring the lines between authentic patriotism and orchestrated messaging. Just as blockbuster films glamorize military action, sports leagues normalize the connection between patriotism and military service, reinforcing regimented narratives under the guise of entertainment. While it is true that genuine patriotism and respect for service members reflect authentic American values, the entertainment industry's careful curation of military narratives serves a deeper purpose, normalizing perpetual foreign interventions without encouraging deeper understanding of these conflicts and their terrible consequences. By conflating support for troops with unquestioning acceptance of military action, these cultural products manufacture consent for engagements most citizens neither understand nor meaningfully debate. The transformation of complex geopolitical realities into simplified hero narratives helps ensure public compliance without public comprehension. Even ostensibly critical movies like the Bourne films and Charlie Wilson's War blend fact and fiction in ways that subtly glorify intelligence work and interventionist policies. This narrative crafting ensures that skepticism of these organizations remains constrained, reinforcing a sense of patriotism tied to state ideals and policies. Alongside these cinematic examples, the video game industry has become a powerful tool for behavioral influence strategies. Franchises like Call of Duty have embedded pro-military narratives in their immersive gameplay, serving as advanced recruitment tools for the armed forces. While Hollywood and gaming recruit audiences into the machinery of war, contemporary music has been weaponized in a way similar to the examples of jazz diplomacy in the 1950s, the British Invasion, and Laurel Canyon musicians discussed before. Nowhere is this more striking than in hip-hop, where the genre's transformation from protest music to gangsta rap illuminates how power brokers co-opt authentic voices to align with the very corporate and political interests that are actively working to subjugate them. Prison profit pipeline. Hip-hop's rise in the 1980s coincided with the crack epidemic, a devastating chapter in American history exacerbated by the CIA's involvement with Contra rebels in Nicaragua, a link exposed by journalist Gary Webb in his groundbreaking investigation. What began as a genre documenting the effects of systemic oppression and the scourge of drugs in black communities soon became commodified. The raw narratives of survival and resistance were transformed into glamorized depictions of drug culture, aligning neatly with authority-driven interests that perpetuate profitable cycles of incarceration and control. The music industry's real agenda becomes explicit through figures like hip-hop icon Ice Cube, who revealed how record labels and private prisons deliberately aligned their interests. "It seems really kind of suspicious," Cube noted, "that the records that come out are really geared to push people towards that prison industry." His assertion that the same people who own the record labels own the prisons exposed the strategic development of content to feed incarceration systems. As Cube explained, a lot of dope songs people like are made by a group of people telling rappers what to say, replacing organic artistic expression with carefully developed narratives. This deliberate shift funneled anger and discontent into self-destructive behaviors, perpetuating cycles of incarceration that aligned neatly with corporate interests. The prison industrial complex demonstrated how systemic control could merge profit motives with social programming. This fusion of surveillance, behavioral modification, and economic coercion would become the template for digital oversight framework, where algorithms track behavior, shape choices, and enforce compliance through economic penalties, just at global scale. What record labels achieved manually in hip-hop, identifying, redirecting, and commodifying authentic expression, would become the template for digital control. Just as executives learned to transform street culture into profitable products, algorithms would soon automate this process at global scale. The transformation from protest to profit wasn't limited to music, it became the blueprint for how all cultural resistance would be managed in the digital age. In part 3, we'll see how these cultural shaping techniques have been automated and perfected through digital systems. The methods of cultural control evolved from physical to psychological, from local to global, from manual to automated. What began with Edison's hardware monopolies and reached its analog peak in the manipulation of popular culture would find its ultimate expression in digital systems. The transformation from mechanical to algorithmic control represents not just a technological evolution, but a quantum leap in the capability to shape human consciousness.